Roving on Shmuel Beis, Perek Zayin, the 7th chapter. And the Navi tells us that as David was established in his home, and he had a period of peace, so he went to Nathan the prophet, and he told him, look, I'm sitting in a house, and the Aron is in a tent. And Nathan told him, it makes sense to me, build the temple. And that night, God shows up to Nathan, and he tells him, go tell David, you're not going to build the temple. You did an important job. You're the king that takes care of the enemies, so that after you, the Jews have a period of tranquility. But bottom line, you killed people, and the temple cannot be built by you. So Nathan comes to David, and he tells him, God says, he will be with you wherever you go. I'll help you get rid of your enemies, and you'll have a great name like the great forefathers. That's what we say in Shmon Esser. We mentioned the only other person we have the patriarchs, and then David, Semach David Avdecha. And the Jewish people will be established, and there will ultimately be a temple, but you won't do it after you finish your days. Your son, he will have an established kingdom, he'll build the temple. And I'll establish his throne, I'll be like him, like a father to him, and he'll be to me like a son. And this is one of the sources to why we don't accept Christian claims. We find many, a few times in Tanakh that God speaks about having a close relationship with a person and calling him his son. And this is one of those sources. For God says about King Solomon, he will sit on your throne, he will build the temple, and he will be to me as a son, and I'll be to him as a father. So that when he sins, I will rebuke him with men who will attack him. We have a tradition that when King Solomon sinned, so Hadad attacked him, and Razum ben Eliada. There were different kings who attacked him, or different generals that attacked him. And I will hit him also with Nig'ei b'nei Adam, with the blemishes that afflict mankind. And our sages say this is referring to Shadim, because during the 130 years after Adam sinned, after eating from Eitz Hadas, so he turned to Chava, he turned to Eve, and she gave him the food. So he said, enough. They lived separate lives for 130 years. And we have on tradition that those 130 years, when he'd go to sleep, so the Shadim would come and warm up next to him and become pregnant from him, however Shade becomes pregnant, however that works, and then have kids. And because he wasn't married, so that allowed the Shadim to flourish. And that's why Shadim are sometimes called Bnei Adam, the sons of ancient Adam, because we attribute it back to him. Exactly how that works is a discussion in Midrashim. We'll leave that for when we study it. So at any rate, we know it's not good for a man to live without his wife, which is what Adam did, and that's why that caused demons to form, however that works. So God says, even when Shlomo, his son, sins, I won't leave him the way I had left Shaul, who did sin, and your kingdom is going to be eternal. And here we have the promise that the kingdom of David, we have the Davidic dynasty, they're the ones that capture the throne. It doesn't say it in the Torah. The Torah says that the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Yehuda will have the throne. But this concept that the kings will remain in King David's household is being promised here. And it struck me as I was reading this chapter that what happened here was David HaMelech walked in and said, I want to establish a home for God. And God said, no, you won't. I'll establish a home for you. That's what happened. When David wanted to establish God's home, God established David's home. David's home, God said, your son will build my home, but from now on, your kingdom is established. And David came and he thanked God and he said, who am I? Who is my father's house that you brought me this far? And you prophesied about me for the distant future. What can I say before you, God? You, out of your kindness, chose to give me all this greatness. Notice David isn't saying, yeah, I deserve it. Most of us, when something good happens to us, we automatically say, yeah, that's what I deserve. David says the exact opposite. He says, God, you, because you're so kind, because you're so giving, you gave me this. And then David praises the Jewish people and how God took them out of Egypt. And now Hashem, he prays that Hashem should maintain his promise. And this is a concept that we find time and again, that things that God promises, we pray that God will keep his promise. Even though God says, I'll keep my promise. But we know that when God promises, predicated on our behavior. God says, I'll give you X, Y, and Z. Well, you, meaning you in this state, if you maintain this state. God promises Yaakov, Avinu, Jacob, that he'll make it back safely to his father's house. And yet Jacob is worried and praying when Esav is coming. Why? Because he's saying, God promised it to me, and that's with the understanding that I'll maintain a certain level. Maybe I sinned. Yeah?
If a person were here, he would jump on that, and he would say, well, you say that it was, there's an if.
That's a fair question. Trying to think if I could answer it in under a half hour. give me 1 second. Remind me, we'll have to discuss that. But it'll take time. We have to sit down with the sources, with the text, and see what does God say about the Jewish people.
Right.
That was part of what we had in last week's parasha, the future parashas. There are certain promises to the Jewish people that are dependent upon their behavior, such as the promise of the land of Israel. And then there are promises where the Torah indicates that even when they'll sin, they'll still be the chosen people.
Right. The one where like we can be said we report for violence because it's so bad that it's what he's gonna do. But then it says no matter what, I think we can mention
that. Right. The Torah says the af gamzot biotam beretoy vehim, lo meastim ve lo gealtim nachalotam nafeu brititam. God says, even when they have sinned and they've been punished and they've been exiled, I haven't been totally disgusted with the Jewish people to annul my pact with them. God foresees, God tells us that we will sin, we will be exiled, we will be punished, and great numbers of punishment are enumerated there. And God says, in spite of it all, you're still my chosen people. So that would be one source. Okay, that's an open verse, yeah. Behind the answer, some of the sages say that this goes back to Shaul's sin. That the original plan was that Shaul would wipe out Amalek, and Shaul was supposed to be the equivalent of Mashiach ben Yosef. He was supposed to fight God's wars and attain a state of peace and tranquility in the Holy Land, and then David would have been able to build the temple because he wouldn't have had to fight those wars. Being the king's son-in-law, he was supposed to continue in the kingship and the throne, and then he would have built the temple and it would have lasted eternally. Our sages say that when David said, "Have I sinned that I spilt this blood?" Your question, David said, I did it the way you asked me to. I did it according to the best in Sanhedrin. God said, no, it's the equivalent of bringing a sacrifice. You did it only when you were supposed to do it. You didn't kill freely. You went to war when it was correct to go to war, and you killed whoever you had to kill. You didn't kill beyond that. and therefore it's not considered a sin, but if you build the temple, it will never be destroyed. And that can't be. So we see that the Jews weren't on a level where they could have a temple that would be eternal. David goes to war against the Philistines, and he is the first one to make them subservient to us since the end of the period of the judges. From the time of Samson, the last judge in the period of the judges, Shimshon HaGibbar, till now we've been having issues with the Philistines, the Philistines, and now David takes them out. He takes over their capital. And don't forget, the Philistines, David has an interesting relationship with the Philistines. When he was at odds with Shaul, the king, he had run away to Achish, the king of Gath, the Philistine king. He's had more than one run-in with the Philistine where things seem to be peaceful. And now, that's it, he's king, he's representing the people, and he does take over the Philistines. And then, he has to avenge his parents' death. When he was running away from King Saul, from Shaul HaMelech, he had placed his parents in the care of the king of Moab, the Moabite king. Don't forget that David comes from lineage of Ruth, who was the daughter of a Moabite king. So when his family's in danger, he entrusts his family, his parents and his siblings, in the Moabite king's hands. And it is never recorded that they left the Moabite king's home. So our sages say that right after David left, he had them all executed. He killed all of David's family, his parents, his siblings. Only one sibling managed to escape, and he ran away to the king of Ammon, who took him in. So now David goes and attacks the Moabites, and he lays out their captives, and he takes a rope and he measures. Two ropes worth get killed, one rope remains alive. And this was a way of doing two things. It was a way of degrading them, and it was a way of also sending out a message of fear that they're not going to start looking and seeing this person is this worth. This one's worth this much to be sold on the slave market, this one's worth that much. That's what the other nations did. You caught captives, you sold them, you made money off of them. That's not what they were doing. They would measure them, take a rope, you fell in on the first rope, dead. Second rope, dead. Third rope remains alive. And in it, if we think about it, I didn't see that it says it anywhere, but this was the exact opposite message of what Moab did to him. They had taken his family, and they said, oh, we have the chief warrior of Israel, his family is worth a lot, we'll kill them all. And David said, well, I'm not working it that way. There's a message that has to be passed. I have a responsibility as king. I'm going to avenge my parents' and my siblings' death from the Moabites, but I'm not going to start saying this one deserves more, this one deserves less. They're all one people who have taken action, and I'm going against the people. And the Moabites were subservient to David. They were considered his slaves. He overtook the Moabite territory. He attacked the nation of Tzova when the nation of Tzova tried to take a small piece of land from Israel. They tried to expand their border to swallow in a piece of land, the river Perat. So David said, no, that's not going to work. And he attacked. When he attacked the king of Tzova, so the Armenian, the Aram Damascus came to assist him, and they lost 22,000 soldiers, and then they lost their right to freedom. David sent our representatives, and we had a governor over Aram Damascus, that's in Damascus. Wherever David went, he was successful. And when he'd capture wealth and loot, he'd put it aside for the building of the temple. Now, when David defeated the people of Aram, so he had his soldiers walk around and bury all the dead, and he became famous for this because it was unacceptable. No other nation did this, that when they won a war, they'd go and bury the dead of the enemy. So David got a reputation that that was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, that he honored the body of the dead of the enemy. David overtook the people of Edom, and David was able to have righteousness in his time because he had a great chief general, Yoav. Yoav fought the wars, and he was able to judge the people righteously. And Yoav was able to succeed in his wars because we had the merits of David being a righteous king over the Jewish people. Now David said, I promised my good friend, my brother-in-law, Yonasan, that I'll take care of his offspring. So I have to check if there's anyone left over from Shaul's family, from Yonasan. And there was a servant in Shaul's family named Tziva. We should remember this fellow, because he's going to show up again towards the end of the book of Shmuel. And this person walked away free, even though he was really a servant to Shaul's family. And David calls him in and he says, you used to head all of Shaul's wealth. You were the top servant. Tell me, do you know if there's anyone left in Shaul's, Yonasan's family? And the servant tells him, yeah, there's one kid left. His name is Mephibosheth. And he's out by Machir, the son of Amiel. And he's a worthless fellow. He doesn't know Torah. He's below Devar. You're going to find him totally disappointing. And David says, okay, bring him back here. And when they bring him, David finds him to be melo devar, filled. Now, the simple reading of this is that Tziva told him he's in a place called, he's in lo devar, a place called lo devar. And David brought him me from the place called lo devar. But our sages say that's not what went on here. This is an allusion to what really took place in the conversation. That Tziva was trying to maintain his freedom. He had kids and he had servants. And really, he had no right to this. He was still a legal servant of Mephibosheth. But he took advantage of the chaos that ensued after King Saul's death and all the children's death, and he attained his own freedom. And really, he was to be Mephibosheth's servant. So now, David's asking him who's left, and he tells David, oh, there's this one kid, he's a cripple, he can't walk, and he's got nothing, you're going to find him to be totally empty. And David says, okay, bring him here. And when they bring him there, David finds him to be melo devar, like male devar, filled. The man knew Torah, he was a tremendous talmid chacham. David found him to be a great sage. So when he comes before David, he knows he's coming before a person who was almost murdered by his grandfather, and a person who's now king and might have it in for him. So he bows before David, and David calls him and tells him, you Mephibosheth? He says, here I am, I'm your servant. He's scared. David tells him, don't worry, I called you here to do kindness because I owe your father, Yonasan. We were good friends. We made a pact. So I'm going to give you back all the wealth of King Saul that had been abandoned and had been overtaken when King Saul died, and then his son who took the throne died. And you from now on are going to be sustained by me. I'm giving you a stipend. You're going to eat at my home. And Mephibosheth bows. He says, what am I? I'm like a dead dog. Yeah, you're giving me all this. David calls Tziva and he tells him, I want you to know I've given everything over to your master's son. You're going to serve him and you're going to be on his field and you're going to serve the land, and you and your sons and your servants, you're all under him. And Tziva doesn't have a choice. He says, for sure, I have 15 sons and 20 servants. We're all going to under Mephibosheth's rule. Now you understand that Tziva isn't going to like this. Him and his 15 sons and 20 servants are now all servants under Mephibosheth. And we're going to see later on that Mephibosheth finds the place to speak badly, that Tziva finds the place to speak badly against his master Mephibosheth, and will attain his freedom, and will attain half of Mephibosheth as well, and will ultimately cause the downfall of King David. But right now, Tziva is being told, that's it, you're his servant again. So Tziva says, fine. Mephibosheth remained in Jerusalem and was sustained by the king. Now, when David's relatives were all murdered by the Moabite king, so his one brother managed to escape to run to the king of Ammon. And now, this king of Ammon passed away, and his son became king. And David said, even though we have a commandment in the Torah that we're not supposed to seek out the welfare of the people of Ammon, they attacked us unreasonably, and they made a boycott against us when we were traveling in the desert, and the Torah commands, "Lo tidrosh shlomam betovatam kol yamecha leolam," don't seek out their welfare. But his father did me a personal kindness. His father saved my one relative that managed to escape from the Moabite king. So he takes his servants, he takes 10 important rabbis, representatives, to go out and comfort the son over the loss of the father. And when they come, so the king of Ammon's servants, they tell him, says in the Torah that they're not allowed to seek out our good. He's not allowed to send messengers to ask you how you're doing and to comfort you over your father's loss. Can't be that he did that. That's against their Torah. And if he sent these people, they must be spies. They're checking out the land. They came here to check out the capital, to figure out how they could attack. So Hanun takes these servants, and he cuts off half their beards, and cuts off half their clothing, and sends them back home. So now they're walking back home, half shaved and half not. And half naked and half not. And they're embarrassed. So they reach the outskirts of Israel, the city of Jericho, known as Jericho because it had great trees flourishing, that when people would come from a distance outside Israel, they could smell the beautiful smell from Jericho. That's what's called Yericho, like the word Reach, smell. So they're at the outskirts of Israel. They've come to the city of Jericho, and David sends messengers to them. He hears what happens, and he tells them, stay there till your beards grow again, till they fill. You don't have to come here and get all embarrassed, and then you'll come back. And the people of Ammon realize that they've just did a bad one. They're in trouble. So they send out to Aram Beit Rehov and Aram Tzova, and they hire 20,000 soldiers and 1,000 soldiers from the king of Maacah and another 12,000 soldiers. Now they've amassed tens of thousands of soldiers because they're prepared for war. They know that after what they did, King David isn't going to sit quietly. And David, it seems from the Pesukim, he wasn't really so clear to go and fight them, but when he heard that they were gathering all of these soldiers, he said, I'm not going to wait. So he sent Yoav and the men, and they come to Ammon, to the gates of Ammon. Now when they approach the gates of Ammon, so from behind them arise all these paid mercenaries. He has tens of thousands of soldiers who have been waiting in ambush for them to come, and after they've come, they suddenly see that they're enclosed. In front of them they have the fortified city of Ammon, and behind them they have the people of Aram, these tens of thousands of soldiers who are attacking them from behind. So Yoav chooses his men, and he tells his brother Abishai, you face behind, take on those people from behind, and I'm going to take the best men and attack from the front. Now there's some logic to that, because paid mercenaries are never going to fight as much as people protecting their city. So Yoav knows that he needs the best men with him. He's going to have the harder fight because he's fighting people who are protecting their homes. These people have vetted interest in succeeding. But people from behind, they're paid mercenaries. They do better, they do worse. Next one they run, they didn't lose that much. So he leaves the rest of the people with Avishai or Avshai, his brother, and he continues to attack against Ammon. And here we have the famous line, Shmuel Beis, Perek Yud Pasuk Yud Beis. He tells him, Chazak v'nit chazak be'adameinu, will be strong and strengthen ourselves for our nation, uve'adarei Elokeinu, for the city of our God, because if we're overtaken, then they'll capture our cities, and they'll rename them after their God. So this is a fight for the name of God. V'ashem yaseh tov be'inav, and God will do what's good in his eyes. And they attacked, and they were successful. The first to run were the paid mercenaries, obviously. So now the people of Ammon are inside their fortified city, and they see that all their paid mercenaries, tens of thousands of men, ran away. So they get as many soldiers as they can in the city, and Yoav feels like the threat has gone, so he comes back to Jerusalem. When Aram sees that they've lost, so they hire more paid mercenaries. And when David hears this, so he gathers the people, they go to war. And this time they decide, if Aram is interfering in what's going on in Israeli territory, we're going to take care of them. And they kill 40,000 horsemen and their chief general. And they have such a victory that Aram sees they're not going to have a chance against them. And that's the last we hear of Aram. This is where we're going to leave off until after Purim. We're about to enter the famous story of David and Bathsheba, and this is where we're going to pick up, God willing, towards the end of the semester after Purim. Next week, everyone should bring, maybe we'll make photocopies of a Hebrew-English Book of Daniel. I think we'll start with the Book of Daniel, with a long introduction, and Mitzvah, we'll go from Daniel to Ezra and Nehemiah to the Book of Esther.